everybody. Welcome to episode 537 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a new Comics Wednesday episode for Wednesday, October 10th, 2018. I'm going to be talking about a few of the books that came out today, as well as running down a list of some other titles that I think you might be interested in. So there was actually a lot of really good books that came out this last Wednesday, but I couldn't get to all of them. New York has me still a little bit behind, so apologies for that. For those of you who kind of count on the New Comics Day Wednesday episode being out at 6 a.m. Eastern on Wednesday before you get to the comic shop on Wednesday, again, apologies. I'm trying to get caught up. Problem is, of course, I'm behind on the day job stuff as well, so it's really making it tough right now to find time to record, but definitely we'll get caught up this weekend. So let's go ahead and dive into the first book I'm going to talk about. It's Moth and Whisper number 2 from co-creator and writer Ted Anderson. The art is by co-creator and artist Jen Hickman. We've got letters by Marshall Dillon. Logo design by Jared K. Fletcher, with a cover by Jen Hickman and Mike Martz as editor. So we had Ted and Jen on before the first issue of Moth and Whisper came out. It was a really good interview. I hope you all got a chance to listen to it. And the first issue did a really good job of setting up the world of Moth and Whisper, especially kind of the Art Deco silhouette pieces that Jen did to introduce the Moth and the Whisper. They were absolutely superb, really sublime in the economy of line and the way that she made them seem something more than human. So as we know, Nikki is their child, and they are concerned that their parents have disappeared, and they're doing the best they can to follow in their parents' footsteps and try to find out just what happened. Nikki is gender fluid, and thus the pronoun they, and it really feeds into the idea of identity and as a teenager trying to find yourself and all that stuff. So again, we covered all that in the interview with Jen and Ted, and I do encourage you to go and check it out. But meanwhile, this issue really sets the story in motion. We're really starting to see Nikki come into their own and even make a surprising ally in a way. And we also get to see just how effective the gadgets and the technology that Nikki uses that they got from their parents, just how effective that technology is and how resourceful Nikki is on their own, because there are a few things that happen in this issue that could be disastrous for Nikki, but they manage to think quickly and kind of overcome them. So I think that the dialogue is great, feels authentic, and the storytelling, the art by Jen Hickman is very good as well. So I'm really loving this book, and I hope I've been hearing good things, and I hope that continues, because I think that this is a book that if people gave it a try, they'd really, really like it. So I can't wait to see where it goes next. And I didn't get a chance. Ted Anderson was at New York Comic Con, but I didn't get a chance to talk to him. I was super busy. He was there on the Aftershock panel, but hope to run into him on in the future. And kudos to both him and Jen Hickman. This is a really intriguing and interesting title. So just once again, going to show the quality of the Aftershock titles. They really are quite something. All right, next book I'm going to talk about is Titans number 27. It's written by Dan Abnett. We've got pencils by Brent Peebles, inks by Matt Santarelli, colors by Ivan Placencia, letters by Dave Sharp. It's got a really cool Clayton Henry cover, and then it's got a variant cover as well that's by Jose Luis, Richard Friend, and Pete Pantazes. So I read this title. Now, keep in mind, I'm not caught up with Titans. I want to be caught up with Titans. I can't read everything. It's so hard to be caught up on everything. But I wasn't sure what kind of fallout from Heroes in Crisis with what happened to Arsenal in that title. I wasn't sure how much of that would play out here. It turns out we just get a couple of pages with Donna Troy, and there's not even any words. So it's pretty impactful, actually. It makes you wonder. Meanwhile, the rest of the team is reeling from what happened to Nightwing in Batman 55, and they don't know how to handle it, really. You know, Nick's the one that brought this current iteration of the team together for the specific goal of, you know, finding these people whose powers are manifesting themselves currently and are kind of out of control. And that's a good metaphor for what's going on with this team without Dick's leadership. You know, Beast Boy especially seems like he's losing it. Miss Martian feels that it's up to her to step up and be the leader, but she doesn't necessarily have everyone's trust, and she doesn't really want the job. Meanwhile, Raven is at one end of the spectrum as far as emotions go. She's been separated from her soul self and can't feel anything, even though logically in her head she knows with all these tragedies she should be feeling things deeply. And Donna Troy is feeling enough for the both of them with you know, what happened to Dick and what happened to Arsenal and the team falling apart. And she's losing it herself. So it's a really tough issue, but it shows the strength of Abnett as a writer, in as much as there's not really any action here. It's not like the team is fighting anyone or responding to some kind of crisis or emergency. It's just relationship. And yet Abnett makes it extremely compelling and a very, very good read. Also the art by Brett Peoples. You know, a book like this, a lot of talking heads, a lot of facial expressions, and it can get boring, right, when there's not a lot of action. So kudos to Brent Peoples and the rest of the art team. Ivan Plasencia, I think he's a great colorist. So he does a good job of kind of toning down the colors just enough to give it a little bit of a somber mood. So kudos to everybody involved. And I'll especially throw out a shout to Dave Sharp, because he does a great job with both Gar as well as Raven of making their thought balloons a little different than, or word balloons rather, a little different than normal to kind of help show that emotion. And it's something that I think letters don't get enough credit for. So I want to make sure that I gave him a shout out. So great job. And if anything, this just shows me I really need to be caught up on Titans, because this book is really good. All right, next title I'm going to talk about, I also read because of Heroes in Crisis 1. Again, I wanted to see the fallout of what happened to Arsenal. It's Red Hood and the Outlaws 27, another title that I'm woefully behind on and have heard nothing but good things about from writer Scott Lobdell. Art on this particular issue is Pete Woods, including pencils, inks, and colors, and letters are by the great Troy Pateri. So it's basically Jason Todd out on the road, out on his own. You know, Artemis is missing. Bizarro is missing. Last he talked to Roy in the annual, Roy was going off to rehab, and we now know him to have meant sanctuary with that. So that's pretty interesting. It's Red Hood and the Outlaws, right? I mean, that's what the title was, except now that he's here on his own, we're seeing Red Hood Outlaw. And in fact, the name of the issue is Outlaw. It's Outlaw Part 2. So I guess it's turned into a Red Hood book on its own. And I'd be very interested to talk to Scott Lobdell. And because when I talked to him when he launched this book, it was all about relationship, right? That's what it was. He was completely focused on that the team had evolved from the new 52 version of Red Hood and the Outlaws, from Arsenal and Starfire and Jason Todd, to Jason Todd, Artemis, and Bizarro. Obviously, Arsenal showed up in here in this title from time to time, But now it's Jason Todd out on his own. And the impactful part of this issue isn't, it isn't Jason Todd pursuing the kind of the shadowy organization that he's after, who seemed well equipped and formidable. It's the impact of this issue. It's not, you know, the action, or as I said, Jason investigating and taking on that organization. It's Bruce Wayne showing up to give him the news, and it almost seems like, in a way, Jason knew already, right? And rather than accept it, he's like, well, you know, I died, Bruce, and you died. And so, you know, death is like a revolving door to us, and he doesn't necessarily want to accept it. But you can tell that underneath, he's obviously, he's very affected, which you don't really think of Jason Todd as an emotional character, but this book is worth it for the one page, or the full page scene, Bruce and Jason consoling each other over what happened to Arsenal. So that's worth the price of admission right there. It was a very impactful scene. I know for a fact this is a book that's flying under the radar. And if you haven't been checking it out, I would encourage you to pick up at least this issue. All right, next up is a book that if you could only buy one book this week, this is the book you need to buy. It's my book of the week. It's Hawkman number 5 from writer Robert Venditti, pencils by Brian Hitch, inks by Hitch and Andrew Curry. We've got colors by Jeremiah Skipper, letters by Starkings and Comic Craft. What Venditti has been able to do is, in every issue so far, he's been able to end on a really good story beat, not always a cliffhanger, but he, in every issue, he's given us some really iconic scenes that really kind of capture the essence of Hawkman at certain periods over his long history. And in this one, issue 4, I should say, the way it ended, it was all about the Atom, right? Hawkman and Atom, that classic team up, I would argue just as important as like Green Arrow and Green Lantern, or Batman and Robin, some of these other team-ups that have been just, really good team-ups. Power Man and Iron Fist, that's another one. These guys are just made to work together, and they complement each other so very well. And it's great to see that Venditti understands their relationship very well. He brings it across on the page extremely well, with the way that they fall back into an easy rapport with each other, and with Adam helping to explain both to Hawkman and to us as the readers what's been going on with him, like what the Adam's theory is on what exactly Hawkman has been doing. And you pair that with some incredible cinematic art from Brian Hitch, including this full-page spread where Hawkman is flying across this reddish landscape of the Microverse with the Atom riding on his shoulder. I mean, it's an incredible piece of art. So now that we've started to understand what exactly the Hawkman's doing, skipping through time and checking out these varied lives, the pieces are starting to fall in place. And again, it's extremely apparent that Robert Venditti has done his homework on this. He's cleaning up the Hawkman continuity in ways that has never been done before. And there's not going to be any need for any writer to come in later and have to tweak anything or throw anything out that Venditti's crafting here. There's going to be plenty of room for other writers to come in and tell their stories if they want to at some point of Hawkman over various periods of his long, long life. Whether it's you want to tell stories of Hawkman as a Thanagarian policeman, sure, no problem. You want to tell stories of Hawkman in ancient Egypt, sure, no problem. You want to tell stories of Hawkman as somebody from Ran, the world most closely associated with Adam Strange, you could do that as well. And maybe the most important one for me, or the one that I'm most looking forward to, is Hawkman as a Kryptonian. So what does that mean? Telling stories of Hawkman as a Kryptonian? can you bring that Kryptonian Hawkman to Earth and we'd get like a Hawkman-Superman hybrid? That would be amazing. So Venditti's managing to tie in all these disparate elements of Hawkman over the years to craft a superb story that's so much fun to read. It's not dark and brooding like Hawkman shouldn't be, but has been in the past. You know, the Savage Hawkman, I feel like, was a misstep in the New 52, trying to establish an identity for him. And that's really at the heart of what Venditti's doing. He's establishing a baseline. He's establishing an identity for Hawkman, for Carter Hall, so that we understand who he is. And it's going to be the foundation for all Hawkman stories going forward. And again, it doesn't mean that as a writer, you can't go back and explore previous lives that Hawkman has lived, where his personality may be, you know, a little bit different. Maybe he's got a little bit harder edge, or maybe he's a little more scientifically inclined. Maybe whatever tweak the writer wants to put on it, all that is still possible, and it still counts. It doesn't discount what Venditti's doing, but what Venditti's doing is he's really weaving Hawkman and Carter Hall into the very fabric of the DC universe throughout its entire history, and making him the integral part of the DCU that he's always kind of been. But the problem has always been that it's been too complicated, and it's been changed around so many times that nobody's really wanted to touch it. And they're just like, you know what, we're just going to kind of stick him over there in the corner and forget he's there and not deal with it. Venditti's dealing with it in such a way that's going to make it so easy for anybody who comes after him to pick up the threads and tell the story going forward. So as much as I love the Geoff Johns run of Hawkman, and I think it's really, really good, Venditti's gone even one step further. And I really hope, and I wonder if Jeff is reading Venditti's run on Hawkman, because it is so amazing. This is this may be the best thing that Venditti's ever done. Now, I'm a huge Green Lantern fan, right, among other characters. And I saw Rob at the New York Comic Con this last weekend, and I told him, as much as I like Green Lantern more than I like Hawkman, if his Green Lantern run goes anywhere near as long as, or rather, if his Hawkman run goes anywhere near as long as his Green Lantern run did, so say Hawkman goes, let's say 50, 75 issues, I'm going to be forced to say that his Hawkman run is better than his Green Lantern run, which is really saying something. I mean, based on the strength of that Green Lantern run, I gave Robert Venditti my Writer of the Year last year, the Writer of the Year for 2017 for the Comic Source Awards. So for me to say that this is even better, you know, it's really saying something. And Rob says that this is the favorite thing that he's ever worked on as well. He's really knocking it out of the park here. And I really encourage you all to pick it up. It's classic, fun superhero comics. You don't have to know a ton about Hawkman to dive right in. You don't need to know what's going on in the other corners of the DC universe. It's kind of off on its own. It's Rob just telling the story of Hawkman that he's come up with. And it's so good. It really, really is. From the cinematic art of Brian Hitch and the great storytelling that he has, to Rob's dialogue, to the overall big ideas of the series, it's really hitting on all cylinders. Now, I have said in the past that I'm not a big Brian Hitch fan, and he's really winning me over with this series, though. I'm still not necessarily a fan of his line work necessarily. His lines are a little heavy for my taste. I prefer a little bit of a more delicate line, but I cannot fault the man's storytelling or the way he moves the camera around in the panels, his layouts. All that is absolutely top notch. So Hawkman 5, Book of the Week. If you only can buy one book this week, this is the one it needs to be. And if you're waiting for the trade, you know, I guess that's okay, but I don't know how you don't just fill your Hawkman desire on a monthly basis. I don't know how you can only pick up and read the story a couple times a year. I couldn't do that. It's too good. I couldn't wait. It's absolutely incredible. So kudos to Venditti and Brian Hitch and the rest of the creative team. I should specifically mention Jeremiah Skipper, the colorist, who's been tasked with coloring these different periods of time. You know, we've been to ancient Egypt, we've been to Thanagar, and now we're in the microverse, and he's handling it all very deftly with some brighter colors, and it's really helping to set a tone that this isn't the dark, brooding Hawkman. This is an adventure story. This is a whole lot of fun, and the colors are definitely a part of that. So great job, everybody. I think that Hawkman 5 is the best issue yet, which I think I have said about every single issue. You just don't think this creative team can continue to top themselves, and yet they do. And I'm especially looking forward to Hawkman 8, which is the issue where we should see Hawkman as a Kryptonian. I wish I had more time to talk to Rob at the show. I was so busy. I would have liked to have probably off the record talked a little bit about the Kryptonian Hawkman. And then, you know, Rob also has a Vertigo title coming up with artist Andrea Muti that's based in World War II. And it would have been great to talk to him a little bit more about that as well. So maybe we'll have him on the show again soon so we can get caught up. But Hawkman 5, definitely my book of the week without question. All right, next up, I'm going to talk about Wonder Woman number 56. This is The Witching Hour, part 2. It's written by the creative team of James Tynan. The pencils are by Emmanuel Lupocchino. Inks by Ray McCarthy. Colors by Romulo Fajardo Jr. And letters by Dave Sharp. So this is the second part of the story where Wonder Woman has discovered that she is marked by Hecate, and she has within her the ability to wield great magical power. So her, along with the rest of the members of the Justice League Dark, go to see Circe, who has been a Wonder Woman enemy in the past. And it's kind of strange. She starts out as an enemy. It seems like she's not real happy to see Wonder Woman and her allies. She's full of bluster and fury. And then Wonder Woman shows her the mark of Hecate. And Hecate is sort of the mentor or the patron god of Circe. And Circe calms right down when she sees that. She seems to have a great understanding, maybe a better understanding of anyone, just who Hecate is. And all of a sudden she's willing to help. So I'm not familiar enough with Circe to know how this reads. It reads a little weird to me. I think I need to do a little more research on who Circe is, because all of a sudden she seems to be on the side of angels. So I'm pretty confused about that, actually. So yeah, I'm just not sure what exactly is going on, but I said before when I read the Witching Hour, well, really it started in Justice League Dark number 3, where Tynan really upped the game, and that entire creative team just blew it out of the water. And then that really continued with the Witching Hour part 1. And now the story is just continuing here, where Wonder Woman is really, she's the one driving the team. She's the one making the decisions, even if they don't necessarily seem to be on the same page as a team. There seems to be some disagreement, some difference of opinion in what's the best way forward. But at the end of the day, Wonder Woman is the one that has the power, and she's a natural leader, and she's calling the shots, much to Zatanna's chagrin. But what remains to be seen is whether these decisions that Wonder Woman's making are for the better or if they're going to be for the worse. But it's a really fun story. And again, super busy at New York Comic Con. I didn't get to talk to James Tynan about it, except for like 2 minutes. Basically told him that he was knocking out of the park, And he really appreciated hearing that. He was a little nervous that it wouldn't hit with the impact that he wanted it to. But I assured him that that it is hitting with a lot of impact, and it's clearly important to the magical corner of the DC universe. The events going on here are gonna shape that. Shape the magic and the way magic is used going forward in the DC universe for at least the next year or so, if not longer. So it's great to see James coming into his own as a writer, and it really has been ever since for me anyway, ever since that run on Detective that started with Rebirth and the Batman team book. So I know that was a dream project for him, and I know working on Justice League Dark is another dream project for him. So kudos to him. The art by Emmanuel Lupacchino. You know, it's interesting. I didn't even necessarily recognize this as her art, and usually I recognize her art right away. I think it's that I've never seen her work with Ray McCarthy as inks before, and I think maybe Ray went a little heavy with the inks, and it kind of obscured some of the flow of Emanuela's art, because usually her art is very soft, and it has a really good flow to it, and it feels very full of life and kind of light, and this is a little heavier and darker. So I don't know if McCarthy did that on purpose, because it is a story that's kind of has some dark overtones with Hecate and what's going on, and the menace of the Upside Down Man and the powers that are aligning themselves against Wonder Woman in the Justice League Dark. So the art was good, but it wasn't great. And again, I just, every time I've seen Emanuela do interiors before, it has been great. So kind of threw me off a little bit. Like when I went to look at the credits and I saw it was Emanuela, I went back through, and once I knew it was her, I was like, oh yeah, it's obviously her. But again, it just doesn't have quite the same deft touch and kind of thin, fine lines and lightness that it does. In some places it does, particularly Wonder Woman's face usually. But some of the other, like John Constantine and Detective Chimp, their faces don't really look that much like Emanuela's art. So not sure what happened there, but Romulo Fajardo Jr. on colors, one of the best in the biz. Can't complain about that at all. So the story continues in the next issue of Justice League Dark #4. So very curious to see what happens next in this Wonder Woman Witching Hour story. All right, last book I'm going to talk about in detail is Rose 13 from writer Meredith Finch, with art by Ig Guara and colors by Triona Farrell, letters by Cardinal Ray. I think Meredith and the rest of the Rose team took a month off, maybe 2 months, from the end of issue 12 until 13. 13 picks right up where 12 left off. And if you're not familiar with Rose, I highly encourage you to go back and listen to the interview I did with writer Meredith Finch. It's an all ages tale, a little dark. It's about a girl who has magic in a realm where magic is outlawed. And she has an animal, a cat, that she is supposed to bond with. She herself is a guardian and kind of a force for good, a force for light, even though the evil queen of the kingdom has banned magic and banned cats and banned guardians. And this is the story of Rose trying to bring the world back from the brink of darkness. So this issue, we see Rose confront Drusilla, the evil queen, for the first time directly, and things don't necessarily go the way that Rose would want them to. But what we have learned is that over the course of the first 12 issues, Rose has, through her steadfastness and her belief in herself, her growing confidence, and the biggest thing is just how much she cares and how big her heart is, she's really managed to gather around her a team of people who are very dedicated to her and care a lot about her, maybe more so than they care about what happens to the world. So even though it doesn't end on a great note for Rose, I have a feeling that things might be okay still, because her companions, her compatriots aren't going to let her down, and they're not going to stop until they help Rose complete her mission and help bring some light back to this kingdom. The art, it's interesting. It's the same artist as the first 12 issues, but yet the art here seemed a little bit more chaotic. So I'm not sure what was behind that change. And also the colors are a lot darker as well. So I don't know if that was a conscious change by Triona Farrell, or maybe it was Meredith or Ig that said, okay, things are getting a little more bleak, so we need to kind of tone down the colors. I mean, that very well may be the case. I'm not saying the art's not good. It's very kinetic. It's very expressive, and it's certainly fantasy art. You won't mistake it for anything else. It just wasn't quite as clean as the first 12 issues, which where I really really enjoyed the art. This was a better than average, but not as good as I've seen Ig do in the past. So I do recommend Rose, especially if you have young readers. I think it's a great story. And I won't say it's simplistic storytelling, but it's ideas and concepts that are easy to understand, right? As fantasy sometimes can be. It's on the surface, you know, good versus evil. You can understand the character motivations, and they're pretty apparent and easily understood. But what's great about this, and Meredith, I talked about this when she was on the show, is that there's a lot underneath the surface that if you're an older, more sophisticated, mature reader, that you can kind of tease out. And I think that a lot of that has to do with like Drusilla's motivations and Rose's struggle early on to have belief in herself. Those are things that some older, more sophisticated readers can kind of relate to and pull something out of worth from the story there. So it's a great story, and kudos to Meredith and the rest of the creative team. I saw her in New York as well, and she was really excited that just recently at the Baltimore Comic Con, she had her first cosplay. Somebody came up dressed as Rose, which I was over the moon for Meredith. I know that had to be so amazing for her. And the person that cosplays as Rose, it took her 3 months to make the costume. So I don't know what her name is, and she's probably not listening, but if she is, hey, great job. Way to make Meredith's day, week, month, con season, probably even, because it's really something when you see somebody cosplay as one of your characters for the first time. So whoever you are, cosplayer, congratulations. That's really awesome. So, all right, that's going to do it for the issues that I am going to talk about in detail. Let me give a rundown on some of the other titles that came out on Wednesday, October 10th, from Aftershock. In addition to Moth and Whisper, we also had The Last Space Race number 1. So I hope you all listened to Aftershock Monday this week. I talked with writer Peter Calloway about that series. We also had Hot Lunch Special number 3 that came out this week, and I'm actually going to put the interview I did with the creative team of Hot Lunch Special at the end of this episode. So you'll hear from writer Elliot Rahal, artist Jorge Fornes, as well as letterer Taylor Esposito. So that's been a really, really great title. You know, if you're a big fan of the Coen brothers or Fargo or those kind of things, you really should be reading that book. It's family, it's drama, it's crime noir, and it's really excellent. So be sure you're checking that out. And then Animosity number 16 from Marguerite Bennett also comes out from Aftershock on the 10th. Over at Boom, we have Saban's Go-Go Power Rangers number 13 from writer Ryan Parrott. Meanwhile, at DC, in addition to a lot of the books that I already talked about, Border Town number 1 has a second printing. The first one sold out, and by all accounts, it's an excellent story. So if you missed out the first time around, you want to know what the buzz is about, definitely try to pick that up. Catwoman number 4 has a really cool foil cover by Joelle Jones, as well as a variant by Stanley Luau. A lot of the DC books have foil covers this month at no extra charge, so if you're looking to pick up some DC books, you're gonna have a tough choice, because sometimes the foil looks great, but the variant cover is also awesome, and then it's like tough to choose, right? Most of the time I can narrow it down to one cover on titles, but for DC this week, there were a few that I had to get both. The Detective Comics 990 is out, as well as Flash 56. That's got a really cool foil variant from Dan Panosian. That one I was able to choose. I was like, Dan Panosian? Yeah, I'm picking that one up for sure. I mentioned Hawkman 5 already. I mentioned Red Hood and the Outlaws. Oh, also Plastic Man number 5 is out as well. Haven't had a chance to read that yet. And I also didn't get a chance to meet Adriana Mello in New York Comic Con, even though she had a table there. I went by her table a couple times, but she wasn't there. And I really wanted to talk to her about Plastic Man and have her on the show. So I may reach out and see if I can get her on remotely. So we'll see there. Also, Supergirl 23 is out. That has a foil cover by Stanley Lau, and then a variant cover by Amanda Connor. That's one of those ones where it's really tough to choose. Also, Superman 4, Yvonne Reese foil cover, this reddish tint that I just had to pick up. But then the variant was an Adam Hughes cover, which is one of the coolest Adam Hughes covers I've ever seen. It's Superman leaping over the Daily Planet building. You know, leap tall buildings in a single bound. I mean, it's instant classic. I had to pick it up. It's incredible. One of the best Superman covers I've ever seen, and probably my favorite Adam Hughes cover ever. It's exquisite. So definitely had to pick that up. And then Michael Cray number 12 came out as well. Haven't had a chance to check that out yet, from writer Brian Edward Hill. Over at IDW, we've got My Little Pony Nightmare Nights, number 1, new limited series in the My Little Pony world. At Image, we have Birthright, number 32. That series is starting to wind down from Joshua Williamson. We also have Crowded, number 3, from Christopher Sabella and Company. That's been a really fun series so far. Infinite Dark, number 1, from Ryan Cady and Andrea Muti. Again, a title that we spotlighted here. We talked to Ryan a few weeks ago, right before Final Order cutoff. And I, again, encourage you to go back and listen to the episode, the interview with Ryan. That sounds like it's going to be a really fun series. I've read the first issue already, and it's outstanding. It really, really is. I can't wait to see where it goes next. We've also got Kick-Ass number 8. Murder Falcon number 1 has a lot of people talking. The latest issue of Oblivion Song by Robert Kirkman is out. That's issue number 8. And also we have the latest issue of The Walking Dead, do we? No, we have some anniversary issues, that's what it is, of The Walking Dead. There's blind bags. You basically buy these blind bags of The Walking Dead, and you don't know what issue you're going to get. You could get 15th anniversary edition of Walking Dead number 1, or you could get a 15th anniversary issue of Walking Dead number 2, or number 7, or 92, or 98, or 27, or 19, or 171. You just don't know what you're going to get, but it's a 15th anniversary special cover of those particular issues. So if you're into Walking Dead, you're probably going to want to pick up a few of those and see if you can get the issues you want. Meanwhile, over at Marvel, Amazing Spider-Man from Nick Spencer and Ryan Otley is up to number 7. Avengers from Jason Aaron is up to number 9. Captain America is up to number 4 from Ta-Nehisi Coates. We've got the third issue of, or the second printing rather, the third issue of Cosmic Ghost Rider, number 3 by Donny Cates. That's been selling out every issue. Domino from Gail Simone is up to number 7. The Immortal Hulk from Al Ewing is up to number 7 as well. And I got a chance to sit down with Al and talk Immortal Hulk at New York Comic Con, and it was really, really cool. So look for that coming up really soon on the show. We also have the first issue of The Spider-Geddon. It's number 1 of 5 out this Wednesday. Venom, which has been a super hot book from Donny Cates and Ryan Stegman, is up to number 7. That's out this this Wednesday, as well as a couple of X-Men books that you might want to check out. We've got X-Men Black Mojo, number 1. as well as X-23 number 5. And then the last book I'll mention is from Valiant. We have a Ninja K number 12 from Christos Gage. So those are a few of the titles you should be on the lookout for this week as you head down to your local comic shop. So I'm going to go ahead and play the interview for you I did with the Hot Lunch creative team. But first, I just want to thank everybody for joining as always. Please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on iTunes. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, be sure to check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, I want to thank everyone for listening. I'm going to play the interview for you now, and we'll talk to you next time.
All right, this is Jace coming to you live from the floor of New York Comic Con. I'm here with the creative team for Hot Lunch Special, writer Elliot Rahal.
Hello.
Artist Jorge Fornes. And letterer Taylor Esposito. I wonder if... let's start off with an easy one.
Okay.
Right? Because we're all a little tired from last night, probably.
Sure.
How's the reception been so far? We've got 2 issues out and 3 out soon, so...
It's been very positive, and it's been very nice. I don't really know how to deal with compliments, but it's been really cool. But it's been really cool to see people responding to Jorge and Taylor's work. You know, it's fun to see... It's fun to see that because, you know, we're a team and we've all worked hard and you know, these two guys to my left of me care very deeply about it, and that's very cool. So that's been amazing for me.
So how about you, Jorge? Have you been hearing good fan response?
Fan response on the book. People, fan response on the book. How do you feel about people liking the book?
Ah, okay. Well, I love the script of Elliot. And I'm enjoying a lot to do this book because I like the noir and the crime histories. And now we have the chance to do a big story, a familiar crime, and I love it to work with.
Now, when you first heard about the project, were you really excited to tell a story of family and crime? Yeah. Like that combination interested you from an artistic perspective?
Yeah, we saw a lot of movies. Good Father, Fargo, to get some, to smell Minnesota, you know? And
you did it, though.
Yeah.
Have you ever been to Minnesota?
Yeah. Well, I hope. I like this kind of movies, you know? And, well, really, I don't know which is the perfect way to do a comic like that. But we are trying to... if there was a movie, maybe a Coen movie, Coen Bros movie, or David Lynch, maybe a little bit like David Lynch movie too.
I could see that.
And get all these references and put inside the comic book, yeah?
Yeah, and it's gorgeous to look at. Now, let me ask you, Taylor, about Rissat. I mean, you're prolific. You've been around the industry for a long time. So you may have a little bit...
You doing okay?
Kind of more experience dealing with, just the fan reception and how it's being received. So what's your perspective on the book so far?
I mean, it's just been amazing. I get to work with one of my best friends ever, Elliot. Jorge, who I'm, like, astounded by. And we're just having a blast, you know, like, I see people talking about it and everyone's, like, excited, and like, yeah, like, this is freaking awesome, you know, like, we're doing something different and something incredible.
And if,
I just wanted to add a bit about, like, Taylor, like, you know, I mean, Jorge, you know, I read a script, and Jorge will take that script and just rip it up and just, make it so much better. And then, you know,
it's a liar.
And then, you know, Taylor sees the scripts and, like, he's got to adjust based off of, you know, the interpretations that Jorge has made. And so he does that really well when sometimes, like, it's like even I get a little confused looking at the the matching art, and then like, but then you know those little things, those little lines, little jokes, those little marks, asterisks, the little bolds, like it you know, it's so underappreciated because like you read in your head and you see it and you read it the way it's supposed to be said, and Taylor does that, and he also has an empathetic brain, so he knows, and we're friends, so he knows like what I, how I talk almost, you know. It helps a lot.
So I wonder, Elliot, now that the book is kind of out there in the wild, you know, last time you were on, first issue hadn't come out, has the reception and the fact that the book's out there now, has it changed at all, like the way you describe it to fans when they come up?
No. I think I'm a little bit more comfortable talking about it now, I think, but that's only because I've gotten used to it and because, you know, I'm such a guy with a great support system, you know, I mean, but no, I'm not comfortable at any time or any place.
Well, let me ask you, Taylor, I always find this interesting, and I've said it many times on the podcast that in a way, I think of letters as like baseball umpires, and that the lettering is underappreciated, and the best lettering you don't notice, right? And when you only notice it when it's done poorly. So, you know, maybe like an NFL coach, right, or a major league manager, they get blamed when things aren't going right, but when things are going good, nobody gives them credit. It all goes to the players. So, so thank you, first of all, for what you do. And also, can you talk a little bit about the fact that, you know, you do what you do as kind of the last step before books go out to printing? And tone and mood is set, for the most part, by the art, but you also have a way of affecting like the final mood in a panel or the way a panel is received, not only with effects in the lettering, but also where you place the word balloons, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the way I look at lettering is kind of like drumming in a band. You're not going to really notice the drumming. It's kind of just there to set the pace. But obviously, if it's off, you're going to know what's going on with this drumming. But it's the thing that sets the beat. Like you said, if I put the balloon in the top left corner, it's going to be read differently than if I put it right next to the other balloon on the bottom right. You know, like that breadth of space will tell you whether or not this is like a long, drawn-out conversation or kind of rapid-fire, like one and one and one and one. Everything is perception. That's what I'm trying to do. You know, I try to get the idea that Elliot has written down and Jorge has drawn with the proper pacing and mood that it deserves.
But this is another big problem with lettering too. It's just like you describe, I mean, drumming or bass, I'd say too, but like, so how many bands, like great bass player, great drums, but how many bands like are led by their bass player and their drums? And like not many, but the ones that do stand out are legendary. I mean, you know, Pert, right? Or not Sting, Genesis. Who's
Collins.
Bill Collins, yeah.
Collins before solo project Collins. Yes. Yes. But like for real though, it's hard to stand out in that position, you know.
But if it's not there, you miss it.
It is. If it's not there, this is not it.
Right.
You know, I mean, if it's not there, even with the art and the script, it's not done, ever. But with Taylor, you know, he manages a way to work very, very hard and then also stand out. And I think it's a unique quality, especially in a business like this.
And for you, Jorge, it's got to be tough. Like when you're writing a book, or drawing a book rather, that's a lot of action, it's easy to keep it visually engaging and exciting, right? But when it's a book like this, it's more about relationships and family. Yeah. It's a lot about kind of the interactions with people. You know, we call it like talking head moments. Yeah. So as an artist, how do you keep it, you know, exciting and make sure that the reader's not bored when maybe it's, you know, three or four or pages in a row where it's just people talking? Like, how do you approach that challenge?
Yeah, for me, it's more easy to do comic books like that because I like that kind of history, you know. I don't like too much the action and special superhero comic with a lot of action and no people carefully getting a coffee or something like that. Well, at last I got the Tyler script, and it's very easy to read the script and to see the movie in your head, you know?
That's good. I'm glad to hear that.
And take a little pics from this movie to get into the page after reading.
It's kind of more relatable, right? I mean, you can't fly or you don't have super strength, but you talk to people, right? And that's what you're putting down on the page. So it's what you know, right?
And try to find another ways to talk, to draw the same scene or a lot of people talking, pages and pages. And it's difficult to find different ways to show it. But, well, it's a challenge, you know, for me. I like it.
I think what he does really well, you know, because that's a big fear of mine. And Taylor's been with me almost since the beginning, and I think he's seen me grown a lot. But, you know, the biggest fear I have in indie comics is that when there's too much talking, it A, veers on self-indulgent, which is, I hate that shit. And then B, it could be boring. You know, right? Like, I mean, and so I think what he's been able to do is, even if you look at all the panels and like all the gutters, it staggers it in a way to where like it draws your eye so easily across the page, and then some of the layouts are truly unique to where then when you're done reading it, you just kind of stay on the page for a second longer. And then his acting is phenomenal. I mean, when you have a talking book, you have to have great facial acting.
Yep.
You have to be able to distinguish these characters and see who they are. And right away he does that. Right away. And like, and it just, it was, they became real. It was cool.
But there is a lot of phone conversations too.
Yeah.
And it's difficult to draw phone conversation all the time, you know?
Yeah, I know. There's so much talking on the phone.
Taylor, just one man with a phone.
Yeah.
It's interesting because I'm sitting here thinking, it's like, most often now when we compare comics, you compare the movies, like, look at this big spectacle, whatever, you know, explosions and that. But I'm thinking about it just now, like, this feels almost like a film, like, you know, like the difference between, like, The Godfather and, like, Captain America, whatever. But a film or even a play where the action is drawing you in, you know, like, you watch The Godfather, you're watching the little things. And that's what's going on here. Like, there's panels where, you know, all that's going on is just one person is throwing a bottle against the wall because they're angry. But you get so much emotion and subtext from it. It's like, this is a different thing. And that's what I love about it. It's just fascinating to watch a play unfold on the page.
You know, what I wanted to get across is like, yeah, it's about family and real life and all that shit. Great. But, like, what I wanted... I think what's really important in, I think something that goes unnoticed a lot in crime or noir genres is the banality of it. And like, for example, in The Maltese Falcon, Sam Spade, 3/4 of the way through the book, takes an interview for another case, right? And you don't need that scene at all. But what that scene tells us is that what's happening to Sam right now is going to be done. And he's thinking ahead. And he sees that life is going to move on. And like, I always love that in that scene. Or in The Godfather. Take the cannoli. They just fucking kill the guy. But like, they're like, take the, like, you know, like, get the cannoli. Like, it's like, there's this element of like,
Business as usual,
but also with extreme violence. And like, I mean, you just murdered a guy in a car. Like, and you're worried about pastry. Like, I love that because like, what does that tell us about the characters?
Right.
You know, like, I don't know.
Yeah, there's the scene in Goodfellas too where they kill Samuel Jackson. He's like, they still talk about the coffee. They're like, that coffee to go.
Yeah, they're having fun with them. Like, they're like having fun with that.
Or when they kill Maury. You know, like
when they killed who?
Maury. They get him in the car. He's like, let's go get Danish. I'm talking about this guy over at Nutley. Puck.
Yeah. Like, I think that's like, you know, I mean, the reason why we like noir is because we like the criminals. If we didn't like the criminals, there wouldn't be a story.
Yeah, that's who we're rooting for.
Yeah, you know, and they're wrong. They're the bad guys. There's no one. No one is good in this book.
Yeah,
I
don't know who to. I don't know who to root for, but.
You don't root for, see, that's the thing.
I want to know what happens.
Yeah.
I want to know what's going to happen next.
Sometimes there isn't anybody to root for. That's just a fact of life.
Yeah, exactly. That's real life.
This is real life.
Yep.
Yeah. That's all I wanted to do, and that's all I wanted to do in this. I've always wanted to put up, like, and I think we did it, actually.
Yeah.
I did it. It was a secret goal of mine that I didn't tell these two guys. I always wanted to see in an X-Men book, like, they're all getting ready to go fucking on the bird or whatever, and, like, then, like, somebody's like, oh, wait, I gotta go to the bathroom. You know? Like, you know, like, you're ready to, like, and, like, there is that in this. It's like, you know, I mean, you want to make an indie book about family, and it's got to feel like a real life scenario, you know? I don't know.
Yeah, and like you said, capturing the banality of real life.
Yeah.
Except their life also involves other mobsters,
yeah.
Guns and automatic weapons and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, I really appreciate the time, guys. The book's amazing.
Thank you.
I hope that it continues to do well. And, you know, it's kind of the exception these days, unfortunately, is that a book can be absolutely amazing, but you have the attrition from, you know, first issue to last. So hoping this is one of those books that goes the other way.
Well, and, I don't think Aftershock is taking very good care of it. And, you know, it's a small 5-issue mini, and, you know, maybe we'll do more, maybe we won't. But either way, you know, I'm very proud of what we have. And
yeah, and I think it's a story worth telling, you know, regardless of what the sales are. I think it's very relevant today, and I think a lot of people can relate to it. We all have families, mm-hmm. you know, and you know, I'll keep preaching it because it's I think it's definitely worthwhile. And you know, I told you this last night, Elliot. You know, I was excited for the book. I was looking forward to it when I first heard about it, but then I read the first issue and it completely exceeded my expectations. So
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, it's really awesome though.
It only exceeds expectations because we all worked very hard on it.
Yeah, and I appreciate, as a fan, I appreciate that. The passion that you all have for this book really comes through in the title. So thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you.